You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring Twitter Brand Basics, a half-day workshop designed to help you take your Twitter presence to the next level. Learn more and register now at twitterbrandbasics.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Daniel Rolls. Daniel has been working in digital marketing for the past 16 years, with extensive experience working both internationally, client-side, and in the agency environment. He is a course director for the CIM, a certified Google Squared trainer, and an associate professor at Imperial College and Cranfield School of Management. Daniel has helped organizations of all types use digital marketing effectively, working with a wide range of businesses, from startups to global clients like the BBC, Sony, Tesco, Vodafone, Mercedes, L'Oreal, and Warner Brothers. He is the voice of the Digital Marketing Podcast, a worldwide top 10 business podcast in iTunes, managing director of TargetInternet.com, and award-winning author of Mobile Marketing and Digital Branding. His career has covered both the technical and business aspects of digital marketing, meaning he's able to bridge the gap between the two and make best use of the tools and technology available. Daniel, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we were talking a bit beforehand about a few of the different things that we have in common, but one, of course, is that we're both university lecturers, though, as we discussed, I do like the sound of your schedule a little bit better than mine. You kind of, with some of those bursts, and I'm doing the more traditional 16-week thing. But
I only dip into it kind of twice a year, which is quite nice. So I get to do a kind of 5 weeks at Imperial College, and then I dip into Cranfield for a couple of weeks. And they call you associate professor, but it's an absolute cheat, really, because all the other professors have studied for many, many years to become a professor, whereas you just turn up. They like the look of you, and the students like you, so they end up calling you professor. So
Speaking of branding and nomenclature in higher ed, I think that's one way where the higher ed in the States might be different, because I think our professors and even assistants and associates are mostly very traditionally learned, whereas what we would call lecturers over here are kind of the liking the look of you coming in, coming out. And that's why I'm able to do some of the consulting, speaking, and other work that I do in addition to the teaching as well.
Yeah, I think from a branding point of view, it's just one of those things as well that kind of goes onto your bio, and it kind of makes people realize what you do a bit more simply. And it's kind of like the book thing. And I was kind of fascinated when someone asked me to write a book, and I was like, okay. And I didn't really know the ins and outs of it. And we can obviously talk about that a bit more. But what was interesting to me, the most important thing about writing a book was having the thing published author on your bio. Mm-hmm. And that made a huge difference. So it's funny how these fairly small things and bits of language actually have a big impact on the branding.
Well, you know, it seems like in the circles that we move, you see a lot of those kind of the trifectas, the consultant, speaker, author. It seems like it's a smaller subset that adds educator or lecturer to that. You know, I think a lot of people add that up with you know, kind of the credentialing that comes with writing a book. But what do you think you learn teaching something?
It's interesting, because what I've realized is pretty much everything that I do is one form of teaching or another. And the actual nice thing is that going through and trying to teach somebody else something gives you a much more thorough understanding of that kind of topic area. And it's kind of the same as writing a book, because when you're going to sit there and structure a book, you have to work out the kind of narrative and the flow of the book, the way you're going to structure the content. And that structure and the narratives that you put throughout that are what it makes it easier to remember and to learn. So for me, the process of teaching is fantastic because it makes me have a much more thorough understanding on the kind of subjects that I'm talking about. And actually, there's huge levels of crossover. So if I'm writing a presentation or writing a lecture or writing a training course, that material in some way I can probably transfer into a blog. There's probably enough content in there for a blog somehow as well. And then I also I run an e-learning business. We run a kind of an online learning business as well. So a lot of that will then become interactive content. And then the other nice side of it, you've kind of got feedback because then you're feeding clients from one side of things into another. So I think by grouping those different things together, one feeds the other. But the process of teaching is great because it just allows you to iron out any holes in your knowledge, because what you don't realize until you actually teach someone else is what you don't know. And it really does make you realize, okay, if I'm going to go through this, I've identified areas that I'm slightly weak on, and you can help update your own skills. So as well as constantly teaching, I'm constantly learning because of doing that.
Well, it's interesting because we talk a lot about, you know, reinventing your content and different forms of content that mm-hmm. you can get out of everything that you're creating. But I think teaching is a formidable one that a lot of people don't think about, because I remember the first time I mapped out, you know, the 16-week social media marketing course. I mean, just at a very basic level, all of a sudden, after going through and building all of that content, I could pretty much speak on anything related to the topic, any aspect of it. You know, I could chunk out and it could become, you know, almost a dozen different keynotes.
Absolutely. I think that chunking is really important as well, because when you sit down to plan out something like a 16-week course, there's a lot of content there. I mean, normally in the commercial world, the most you're going to get is a couple of days training course on something. So the fact that you go into it in that much detail, exactly as you say, allows you to break it out. And that chunking is really important. How do you break things up and how are you going to kind of group them together is really important. And actually, it lends itself to the whole content marketing piece quite nicely as well, because I might do a day's lecture on something and that will break down into maybe, you know, 6, 7, 8 different kind of topics. You can take each of those topics and you can create a piece of content on the back of that. And something we very much started doing is trying to put that into a more practical process. So we use a content calendar within our business. So to basically try and talk about the things that we're teaching, the things we're doing e-learning on. And with that, we'll have key themes in the month, and then we'll break that down into lots of different pieces of content. So taking that teaching stuff and the writing stuff and then putting it into the practical terms of the business works really, really well. And I think that just having that depth of knowledge is really useful, because it just allows you to go into things and really see the practicalities and understand the nitty-gritty that you don't normally get into in a single day's course.
So what are some of the courses that you're teaching?
So the academic stuff, the kind of university stuff, is a program over digital marketing overall. So we really look at key trends, and then we go through each of the digital channels, search optimization, social media, and then we try and tie it all together with strategy as well. But then on the commercial side of things, a lot of what I do is going deep dive and really kind of going into things in more depth. So we might do a day or two on digital strategy or on analytics or on advanced search optimization or social media. So it's pretty broad. And when I started off doing training, the question was always, what's your specialism? I used to come back with a fairly weak response, I think, at the time, which was, well, I'm kind of a generalist. I cover a lot of different areas in digital marketing. Now, as time's gone on, that's actually become a great advantage, because the fragmentation of digital channels and just the range of digital channels and disciplines, what was really lacking in a lot of cases and a lot of commercial situations was someone that could bring all that stuff together. So what I find myself doing a lot of time is teaching people the fundamentals, going to some topics in depth, but really then saying, okay, what does this mean from a business perspective? And how are we going to tie all this together? How do we turn this into a strategy? So just putting something, a kind of framework around it all. But I think there's a lot to being said at the moment, a lot for being a generalist and actually having a broad level of knowledge. Not that there's anything wrong with specialism, but that broad level of knowledge seems to work pretty well at the moment in the commercial environment particularly. And I think that's kind of missing. I don't know what your experience is, but it seems to be missing to me, the people that really can kind of bring all these things together.
Well, I think it's kind of what – kind of the overarching piece of it too, because I think, you know, I think we've kind of stigmatized being a generalist as kind of the antithesis of someone that's really, 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 really hyper-specialized.
Yeah.
And without necessarily kind of defining what's good about being a generalist, because I think, especially if you talk about it in the marketing context, you're talking about someone that kind of can see the big picture and, you know, gets, you know, the brand strategy, the marketing strategy, independent of, you know, some deep, deep focus.
Absolutely. And I think the interesting thing at the moment, there's a big trend in a lot of the agencies and organizations talking about digital transformation at the moment, and transformation projects and transformation consultancy. And really what that's about is kind of going in and saying, okay, where are we now? Where do we want to be with our capabilities and digital generally? And how do we move between the two things? And that takes a fairly broad range of skills. Now, the problem with that is there's two key parts to this. The one is that to stay up to date with all of the digital channels, search, social media, everything else, is pretty challenging because it's all changing constantly. And I can talk at great length about trying to stay up to date with digital marketing. But the other key challenge, and this is where I think actually digital marketers have been missing out, and marketers generally, and business people and branders and everything else, is that when you look at digital marketing, why most people are actually struggling with it isn't the digital marketing stuff. It's not the social media or the paid search or any, that kind of tactical stuff. And although that stuff, there's lots of complicated stuff in there, it's more what that stuff creates the need for. You might need a different team structure. You might need different IT and IT infrastructure in place. You need leadership buy-in. You need measurement frameworks. And actually all of those things are the tricky things rather than the actual digital stuff itself. So I think the really good branders and kind of digital marketers and business owners are those people that are able to lead change. And actually, one of the things that most organizations have always been terrible at is change management and actually dealing with these kind of changes. And the reality is that digital is moving so, so quickly. There is a constant need for change. So a lot of these large organizations, and we deal with a lot of these large organizations, are really struggling because all their processes aren't quite right. The team structures aren't quite right. The IT infrastructure isn't necessarily there. And that leads to a lot of frustrations with digital, but it's not actually digital that's causing the problems. It's all that other business stuff that surrounds it that needs to be lined up for this to actually work properly.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were just in going through some work that we'd done for a client and kind of reviewed the past couple of projects. And beyond all of the, you know, what you'd label them as is this is a social media project and this is that, we took a step back and realized what these really are about are bringing about change. I mean, it's kind of wrapped up with a marketing bow and package on it. But a lot of times, like you're saying, it is getting back to doing something that really gets beyond those specialized marketing skills. I mean, I think it's the kind of, again, it's the stigmatized generalist that I think that people need more than we think.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing, I mean, we're with this and absolutely in line with what you just said, when we go into a potential client now, we'll actually audit their digital capability, which is exactly this thing of saying, where are they now? And there was always some key indicators for us how easily it's going to be to implement any particular project. And actually, the things that we always look at first are leadership buy-in. So do the leaders in the organization actually understand this stuff? Are they willing to get behind it? And actually, some of those IT infrastructure issues as well. Like, are we going to be able to build the website? Is there a content management system that's going to work? How bought into this is IT and so on as well? The way my career started, which was I studied computer engineering at the very beginning of my career, and I was actually a computer programmer. And I mean, this is back in the dark ages, but this is basically when digital started. So I came out, I was building websites, which then made me the online marketing manager. And then a marketing manager left. So they said, well, you better look after the marketing then. And I didn't know anything about it. I had absolutely no idea. So I went off and got some marketing skills. And having those marketing and IT skills at that time was the ideal kind of mix of things. And it was great. And it was meant I was able to communicate with those kind of IT teams and so on. And what I'm always surprised by, a lot of the universities that I teach at and at the commercial organizations, when you ask the people that are in charge of the digital marketing or are learning about digital marketing, and you say, how many of you could build a web page? How many of you know anything about HTML and web servers and those kind of things? It's a very, very, very small percentage of people. And I think this kind of highlights again where marketing has kind of siloed itself and said, no, no, this is what marketing is all about. We don't need to know any of that techie stuff. But actually, by being armed with some of that techie stuff, or you know, conversely, in another part of the organization, some management staff or whatever it may be, just makes it easier to communicate and actually easier to get things done. And that change piece becomes even more important.
Well, I think that not only marketing siloed itself, but I think, you know, the other place where we have our respective toes in the water is marketing education. Because you talk about related to the skill sets, you know, who can, you know, code a website or do something. And I know, you know, at the university that I'm at, you know, we have the College of Business is here. The School of Journalism and Mass Communication is here. Sure. Art and commercial design are over here. And I keep seeing these things as, you know, three circles that are far apart that I really wish you could just kind of get them closer so that you could overlap them in some sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing this a huge amount in commercial organizations as well. So within companies, because we had a kind of marketing team, and then you know we had this digital marketing team, and quite often you find the two things aren't aligned, which is quite amazing. But then you say, well, okay, where does digital and where does marketing now live? And it's really complicated because there's a huge overlap obviously between social media and search optimization, between content, between corporate communications, leadership. So actually working out where digital now lives within most organizations has become increasingly difficult because it was kind of siloed off. And because it was siloed off, it wasn't in contact with the right parts of the organization. And we're having to change the structure of organizations. And I think back to your point with education, you know, there is a broad need for people to have knowledge of digital across all areas of a business. I mean, what we're finding increasingly is whether when we go into any organization to do some training, we start by training the marketing team. And then you sometimes find sales are getting involved as well, and maybe some IT people. And it starts to broaden out and broaden out. And we've actually got to the point where we're training reception staff. We're training up people that are working in warehouses and things like that because it's still impacting on what they're doing. And one of the things we always teach is don't think of digital as a channel, because it fundamentally has changed how people are buying things, how people are interacting with one another, how people interact with the world, which means it affects pretty much everything. And I think that's the mind shift that's needed, is to make people think this is not just another channel. It's actually something that impacts pretty much everything that human beings do to one extent or another. So therefore, we need to think about how this impacts all areas of an organization or education or anything else.
Yeah, you said it's not a channel. And immediately in my head, I'm hearing, so what is it? And then I kind of heard a variation when I've spoken on similar topics too is thinking of it more as like just like you said, a layer across the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good way of thinking about it, because when I came to write this book, Digital Branding, and I was kind of thinking, what is digital branding? What does that really mean? And what we realized is that it's kind of like talking about digital marketing. It's a bit of a nonsense to some extent, because branding and digital branding, you know, digital branding is part of branding and digital is part of marketing. All marketing will eventually be digital. Right. But what we said is really it's the sum of touch points. It's the sum of each individual touch point, wherever that touch point is, Twitter, TV, speaking to somebody on the phone, whatever else it may be. It's the sum of all those things that build your opinion of something. And actually, I mean, that's changed pretty dramatically. My favorite answer to a question at the moment when you say to people, how's the customer service? And the answer always at the moment is, it's great if you tweet them. So it just kind of suggests that there's been a complete change in our brand perception of things. And actually, that's what it is. It's the sum of those different touch points. It is a layer that goes on top of everything. And we need to think about how this layer has changed those different things. So, and it's like mobile marketing. That was one of my, kind of pet hates for a little while as well. Saying mobile marketing, what a nonsense. There's no such thing. And it's one of the, I wrote a book called Mobile Marketing. And then the first thing that says mobile marketing is dead. Because when we talk about mobile, it's not a separate thing again within digital. Because mobile impacts our email, it impacts our social media, it impacts our search. I think it's just human nature. We kind of like to quantize things and put them into boxes because it makes it easier for us to think about them. But by doing that, it maybe doesn't reflect the true situation.
Yeah, it's like probably getting into the human need to sort things to make sense out of them. That it's not just marketing, it's digital marketing because I'm talking about Facebook and Twitter and all of this. Whereas for anybody that is really thinking and doing this work, it's all the same animal.
That's it, exactly. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to, you know, you talk, the title of your book, Digital Branding, which was how I first encountered you and which I'm going to use as a text for a new course I have coming up on digital brand development. But I was drawn to it by the title because I think that, you know, talk about labels, even the you know, labels, titles, branding versus marketing. You know, you talk about it being kind of the sum of all the touch points, but where does, first of all, where does branding fit in when it comes to higher ed? Do you feel like it's present enough? Is it getting lost?
I think it gets a bit lost. And I think the reason for that is it's harder to measure and it's harder to judge and understand what it means. So we kind of worked out that you could boil organizations down to about one of three different things. And this is from a really tactical point where what do you actually want people to do at the end of the day? What's the end conversion you're looking for? And it's quite easy when you look at kind of e-commerce. E-commerce is just, you know, you do some effort and something comes out the other end and you can judge the impact. So we all like to look at those kind of things in education just because it's nice and measurable. And then we've got the kind of business to business. And we say, well, actually, it's about services. It's not about, you know, selling products directly online. But it really just means it's about lead generation. You want someone to fill in a form or you want someone to pick up the phone. And then you get to this other huge, huge group of organizations which actually don't directly want either of those conversions. What they want is someone's behavior to change in some way. Now, the two things are connected, and I'll come back to that. But for example, if you are Coca-Cola, you've got somebody engaging with some content online, and then, you know, a month later, they're in a big store and they're buying your product. And it's trying to work out the connection between those things that really, really appeal to me to try and understand it. Because we talk about analytics a lot in digital, and it's one of our things that we're really pleased with ourselves about, that, you know, we've got all this data and analytics. And now what we've got is just overwhelming amounts of data. But the reality of that is that's okay if you're doing e-commerce and it's okay if you want someone to fill in a form. But what about if you want someone to prefer your brand when they walk into a store? And actually, if we're realistic about this as well, why does somebody actually use your e-commerce website in the first place or choose your product over another? There's a lot of branding stuff in there as well. Now, my general feeling on it was that branding was used as an excuse in digital. So you'd say to someone, why did you do that Facebook campaign? They say, oh, it's a branding campaign. And what that actually meant was they didn't know why they'd done it and they couldn't measure it. So, and it was that kind of throw. It was all about branding. And what I wanted to try and do was put a bit of a framework around it and said, what does branding actually mean? And then what impact does that actually have? And how could we go about measuring it? And what's missing is a bit of culture here, actually, because in TV and print for a long time, we'd got fairly comfortable with the idea, or at least a lot of people had, in that you put these ads in front of people and, you know, what happens then? And if you were doing a big campaign, what we'd probably do is some sort of measurement afterwards. And that measurement would normally take the form of some sort of change of behavior study or a questionnaire or a survey or using something like Net Promoter Score. And what all of these things are basically doing is saying, did you see the ad? Did you kind of remember it? But did it change your behavior? Now, I'm still not convinced that things like brand recall, do you remember this, is necessarily a true indicator of did that actually make you do something? But what you can start to do is say, people that experienced all this digital stuff, however, this great interactive stuff that we did, what did they do afterwards? Are they the people that went and bought our products in the store? So it's really about putting a framework around saying, how do all these different touch points impact our behavior? And the reality of this is what we're trying to do is measure the immeasurable, because people don't know why they buy things. I'm reading an absolutely fantastic book at the moment called Decoded, which is supposed to be the science behind why people buy things. Now, the reality of it is if you ask someone why they pick a particular detergent or they pick a particular brand, they'll tell you a number of reasons, but they might not actually be true. So this sum of touch points idea became even more important to me to understand how all these different things that I'm doing are joining together to change the bigger picture. And I think that's quite exciting. And I think we're only really touching the surface with it at the moment. So we've tried to build a framework. The book aims to be a very practical guide as well. So there's the kind of intro section that talks about all the things I'm talking about now. There's the tactical section that tries to go through and say, how does search optimization impact branding? How does email marketing impact it? And then we try and build a measurement framework at the end of it as well. Now, what's interesting for me is that we talk about digital branding and we're talking about putting things into boxes. When I was going to write this book, I said, well, we should just do it. We should do a new workbook on digital marketing overall. They said, oh, there's too many digital marketing books done. So I thought, what else can I call it if I'd like to write that? So then we started thinking about, well, actually, there's a real brand. And that's where the idea about branding came in a little bit more strongly as well. So I didn't go out with the intent of writing a branding book, but actually, after a bit of research and a bit of work, it then really turned into a branding book as well. So I think that framework and measurement and understanding is really the key thing that intrigued me.
It's a great lens to look at. I mean, the title story is funny because certainly a lot of back and forth book title funnery, but I think it's an effective lens for all the reasons that you've just said, you know, with the idea of, you know, branding being the sum total of your touch points. But with digital, we have so many more touch points.
Yeah.
To get in front of people.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I think that's what one of the key challenges that people are dealing with is that the more you teach them about search, email, display advertising, social media, all the myriad of opportunities within social media and so on as well, they actually start to get a little bit overwhelmed. And what we really need to do is take a step back. And a lot of what we seem to be speaking about lately is just aligning the two things, which is what do people actually want to engage with and what do we want to do as organizations? And most of the time what organizations want to say is buy our stuff, it's great. What people want to engage with is completely different. And by understanding that target audience and the journey that they're going through, you can then frame things. But actually, that's where brand positioning and value-based positioning become really important. So if you look at a brand like Nike, rather than thinking of them as, you know, we sell great running shoes or whatever else it is that, you know, the different products they sell, actually, if they position themselves as we help people achieve their athletic potential, that bridges the gap between what they want to say and what people want to engage with, because then they can map that out with things like the Nike training apps and Nike Plus and looking at other routes that people have taken for running and tracks that you can listen to when you're running and all those sorts of things. So a lot of this actually, there's so much talk about content marketing at the moment. That brand positioning piece of what do we stand for is really, really important. And a lot of organizations are failing or succeeding on the back of it. It was interesting because there's a brand in the US that does well and has completely collapsed in the UK, which was Best Buy. Mm-hmm. And in the US, you know, the positioning of being digital expertise and the blue shirts and the geeks working in store and being able to answer your questions. And that was kind of brand positioning, and that tied in with all the marketing they could do. Whereas actually in the UK, their brand positioning was we're the cheapest. Now, that's a very dangerous thing to do in any retail environment when you've got physical stores, because obviously someone will be able to undercut you pretty much online. So it's not the smartest move. But it didn't give them anything to talk about. It didn't really give them anything to engage about. People didn't know what the brand stood for. Therefore, it just didn't work. And actually, it failed in the UK. So I think getting that brand positioning right is really important, because it gives you something to talk about. In a world of engagement and these multiple touch points, that having something to talk about is really important.
Well, you talk about people feeling overwhelmed by basically everything digital. Mm. And I feel like that also gets people, you know, they feel like they're already so behind. They have to dive in and do all of these, you know, the next greatest, biggest digital campaign. And a lot of times they blow right past that brand positioning point. That, you know, is just, you know, you're doomed to fail like you said, it's going to make or break your success.
It is. And I think there's a whole thing about authenticity here as well, because when a brand or an organization or a company or an individual understands what they stand for, that communication will come across a lot more effectively. So by understanding, okay, this is what we stand for, and therefore we've got something to talk about. So when we started our company, we were like, okay, we're going to blog and we're going to create content. What do we stand for? And it was really practical and hands-on advice, which is really simple. There's nothing smart about it particularly. It's just practical, hands-on digital marketing advice. And that tone of voice went through all of our content and how we did presentations and how we produce videos, and it works. And it kind of fits in with our target audience, these people that are trying to educate themselves and they're trying to keep up to date with all this stuff. But I also think the point you made is a really important one about there's so much that people can do. They always want to do the latest, best thing. But actually, going back to basics and saying, what do we stand for? And what channels are our target audience actually using? And by trying to focus on the new and the shiny all the time, there is a bit of a danger. Now, you do need to keep an eye on that stuff and try and keep up to date with it. But what we're encouraging lots and lots of our clients to do now is do less, but do it better. And I think there's this whole thing about content marketing that ties in with this as well, because with content marketing, everyone is now producing content. Everyone's writing blog posts and making videos and doing whatever they're doing. But they're probably not making enough actual effort to do something exceptional. And I think you're better off doing one piece of pretty exceptional content than doing 10 pieces of just yet another blog post that's churned out for the sake of it. And I think someone that has absolutely epitomizes that is Tim Ferriss. And if you look at Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week, a lot of the stuff that he did with the blog in the early days of that, is he would write a blog post that has traffic coming through to it after years and years. And that really got me thinking. I think, you know, let's do something a bit more exceptional. And what we'll now do, when we produce content, we expect two types of traffic from that content. We're expecting immediate social media spike, because we'll tweet about it and we'll LinkedIn update about it and all those sorts of things. And we will get a fairly decent spike of traffic. But then what we expect is that that will build up from a search optimization point of view over a while as well. So when we write a title, for example, of a blog post, we will be thinking about that social media impact, but we'll also be thinking about what's the long-term search benefit of this. Will people be finding this content in 2 years' time? And then we'll go for analytics and understand what's working and what's not, and we'll iterate based on that. But I think having that attitude towards social media is really important, conversation is really important, but also understanding long-term what are people's problems and challenges and trying to answer both of those can be a really useful way of approaching it, because it's meant that for a very small organization, we've managed to punch above our weight to a great extent, because that's giving us a huge amount of good search optimization. So we're essentially a five person organization, but we work with a lot of the world's biggest brands, and we work globally with them as well. So I get to fly all over the place and kind of go to interesting places. And the reason for that, I think a lot of the time, is that people have found us in the search engines, at the top of the search engines. They've engaged with our content. They've listened to the podcast for a long time before they pick up the phone. And I think when they pick up the phone and if immediately they'd heard, oh, there are only five people, they might feel slightly nervous. But because they've engaged with the content and because they feel comfortable and they feel persuaded and the brand has been reinforced before they actually get in contact, they're actually quite comfortable. I think that's fine. They're small but mighty. They're kind of small but powerful, so it's okay. So it's helped us as a small organization scale up a lot as well.
Well, you talk about content and the latest, greatest trends.
Mm.
You know, we're here in 2015. This is, everyone's saying this is the year of podcasting. But why is podcasting such an effective medium for building a brand online?
It's interesting. It's a really interesting question, because I've been into podcasting for absolute years, and we started doing a podcast. It was a very, very slow burn. It took an awfully long time to build up. And then we did the digital marketing podcast, and that built really nicely. But still, you know, it's a subset of the audience, and people weren't always persuaded. And some of the numbers I had was it's about 20% of the digital audience that will ever listen to podcasts. So yeah, it wasn't everybody. But I'll give you an example. The one thing about it is that, or maybe there's a few things actually, but one of the key things is that you're getting different media time a lot of the time. So a lot of people will listen to a podcast when they're driving their car, when they're commuting and they're listening on their phone or whatever, their other device they're listening on. So you're kind of getting a different bit of their attention. And I think that tends to be a more focused piece of attention. as well. So, I mean, even if you're driving, you seem to be fairly tuned into it. And it's quite a one-to-one channel because someone's listening to your voice. And I was going through our stats and for the Digital Marketing Podcast, and we've got, I think, listeners in 177 countries, if I remember rightly. And I was going through, I went to the far end, where have we got one or two or three listeners? And I was scanning through each of these little countries, and, you know, there's people from Madagascar and all sorts of places. And one of the countries that came up was Benin. And I thought to myself, if I'm honest with myself, I couldn't put my finger on the map and tell you exactly where Benin is, I'm embarrassed to say. So I looked it up on the map, and it's next to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I'm quite pleased that I know that now. But I went to the next podcast, and I said, if you're in Benin, you're one of the three people that are supposedly listening in Benin, drop me an email, and I will find you some free stuff. Google will probably give us some free stuff, and we'll send it through to you. And I was pretty doubtful. I thought this was kind of an anomaly in our stats. And we had two emails within 24 hours. People say, I'm so excited to hear from you. It was absolutely brilliant. And I think what it proves is that it's a very, very personally connected channel. It's kind of like listening to a radio show where, you know, you can actually maybe interact with that DJ because, you know, they're at the end of an email. You can tweet them. You can do whatever. And what we found when I was running an agency, because I used to run a search agency and eventually became a full kind of blown digital agency, we were probably getting 15, 20% of all our new business from podcast listeners, where people would listen for maybe 18 months. They would never reach out, never get in contact. And then suddenly they'd pick up the phone, they'd phone the office. And if they would put through to me on the phone, they'd recognize my voice and they were quite excited about it. And they were like, oh, I recognize your voice. I've been listening to you for ages. We'd have a chat and it'd be really nice. And we didn't have to go out and pitch. We didn't then have to pitch against five other agencies. The brand, through the podcast, had already got them kind of bought into us. There was a level of trust that had already been built. So I think it's an interesting channel because you tend to listen for an extended period of time. When you listen to, or you go to a website, you might go for 3 minutes on average. When you listen to a podcast, we found that the right length of a podcast is at least 20 minutes. So actually the long form, the 20, 30, 40 minutes tends to work quite well because that fits in with people's commute. You're getting fairly one-to-one and different media time. It's not just when they're sitting in front of their computers. Some people it is when they're sitting in front of their computers. But also you've got subscription-based listeners. You've got people that listen again and again. And we moved to doing something every couple of weeks at minimum just so we kept up that listener base. And the only complaints we ever get in iTunes, in the reviews about the podcast, is when we slow down the production schedule. This is brilliant, but there aren't enough episodes. So that's a happy kind of place to be in when people are saying that. I also think that the thing that works as well is what makes it work is that the dynamic between the people as well. So you're a very good interviewer. I can say that now because you interview me. I can be nice to you.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. But that helps, and it makes it easier for people to listen to because it essentially means there's a bit of a dynamic between the people and it means that there's a bit of banter. Whereas when you get a lot of the podcasts, when they're just monologues, it's a lot harder to listen to, I think, as well. So it's just making it easy for someone to listen to. Now, there's been a couple of things recently as well that have, I think, led to a bit of a resurgence in interest for podcasts. I mean, I mentioned Tim Ferriss again, but he started doing his podcast and it went straight in at number one in the iTunes chart. He really worked out how to get the listeners. The other thing was Serial, and Serial was the podcast which was basically a kind of mystery novel, but it was delivered via a podcast. And that seemed to get a lot more people interested in. And if I look at my stats for our podcast, our listener base, I think over the last 3 or 4 months, has literally almost doubled against where it was for 2 or 3 months before that. So I think there's a resurgence. There's more people suddenly become aware of the channel. And it's not necessarily the easiest channel to understand because you have to have an app installed or you have to use iTunes or something else, and not everyone's aware of them. So I think that awareness is growing. But I think it is that listening to someone's voice, it feels quite personal, and therefore it tends to get connection with people.
You know, real quick, you talk about it's the year of. The other thing is, you know, that people have been saying for almost years on end is the year of mobile.
Yeah.
And it seems like we haven't quite gotten that right in terms of adapting. And I have to ask the guy that literally wrote the book on mobile marketing. What are we getting wrong? How are we still kind of are we getting any closer to that kind of mobile first mindset?
I think we are. I think what's interesting is that actually, Google won't speak about mobile marketing. They will speak about a multi-screen journey. I think that's probably a good way of thinking about it. Because what's happening, and the reason it's so important now, is that we are all using multi-screens. We're using so many different devices to access all this stuff. But the reality is that organizations aren't really ready yet. And we do this big summit every year with the Chartered Institute of Marketing, and I've been lucky enough, done the keynote a couple of years in a row, and it's a Bloomberg TV. So we kind of have the great and the good at digital marketing in London in a room. And we've asked the same question for a couple of years, which is, how many of you in the room have got responsive mobile optimized websites? So websites that are really geared up to work on these different devices. And it still was only about, of all these really great organizations, about 35, 40% of them that were ready. So what it means is they're saying that, you know, on average, I think in the UK, it's between 30 to 40% at least. I mean, literally at least, in some cases, it's a lot more of the traffic to websites is coming through on mobile devices. In many cases, it's 80% plus. But still, only 40% of organizations had a responsive website. I think this comes back to a point we made early on. This is actually about infrastructure and IT and systems and process and development. And it's slowing people down. It's slowing people from having these websites that are ready. They've got legacy systems. They've got an existing content management system. It's not ready to be adapted. And particularly in the large organizations. Whereas a startup comes out, they go and get WordPress and they buy a responsive theme for WordPress or get a free one, and they're there. And this is only going to become a bigger issue, because if you look at a smartphone, how big does that smartphone need to be before it becomes a tablet? I mean, if you look at the iPhone 6 Plus, it's basically a mini tablet. The whole idea of phablets, you know, somewhere between a tablet and a phone, particularly if you go to Asia, I mean, everyone's using massive kind of phones. What happens if on my laptop I can flip the screen over and it's a touch screen? What about if I'm on my Apple Watch next month? And the reality is there are more and more of these different screens and devices. Google talk a lot about wearable screens, wearable technology, Google Glass, which, you know, it's kind of disappeared. But and also in car, they talk about heads up displays in cars and things like that. So I think the reality is there will be more and more of these screens. We need the agility of having these websites that allow to adapt to these different devices. And I think it's getting to the point now where there's still a lot of organizations that aren't there yet. But if they're not there soon, users are just getting irritated and leaving. And actually, there's a lot of proof that we're less patient on our mobile devices. Google is extraordinarily keen on people having mobile-optimized websites. So we're seeing the fact that it has to be the year of mobile, and we have to be ready for it because it's happened already. And I think it's happened for consumers. Unfortunately, it just hasn't happened for a lot of organizations. And that's the real challenge. I think the other thing that's quite exciting is that the most exciting thing about the iPhone 6 to me was that not any of the kind of new things that everyone was talking about, it was actually NFC. And NFC has been in Android devices for years. So near-field communication, either you can touch your phone on and do something with it. Mm-hmm. Now that it's universally on most devices, or will be going forwards, it means that mobile payments can really take off properly. Because the key thing that was holding mobile payments back in lots of places was the fragmentation of the technology. There wasn't one single way of doing it. And therefore, it wasn't taking off as well as it probably could have done. So I think a combination of consumer demand and universal technologies being more there is really important. And for Apple to build in something that wasn't theirs, I thought was quite interesting. I thought it was quite a brave and quite an important move. So I think we're going to see mobile payments take off more. We're going to see a lot more mobile websites, and it does become hugely important.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and like you said, I think it does. It all connects back to systems, infrastructure, and so many of those things that aren't served well by any of the siloing either. So we've got to figure out how to connect all those dots online and off.
Absolutely. And it comes back to basics. It's think about the user journey. What does the user actually want? How do they want to do it? What devices they're using? And if you think about that, it's a very simple way of thinking about, okay, this is what we need to do. This is how we need to do it. Because if you don't, you'll lose people, and you're going to lose business or engagement or brand or whatever it is that you're looking for. I mean, you still see huge amounts of people tweeting out links to websites that don't work on mobile devices.
Yeah.
And 80% of Twitter usage is on a mobile device. So I think it's just a wake-up call for people, hopefully, that focus on the user journey and really understand what it is that people are trying to do.
So as we start to wrap up, what's a brand that's made you smile lately?
Well, there's a few, and I think what's quite interesting is has the fact it's made me smile actually had an impact? And I was
really, good follow-up question.
Well, I think this is the thing. So there's a fantastic brand in the UK, which is a mobile phone network called Three. And Three, they specialize. They really say, look, it's all about data. We give you the fastest data. And they're trying to change the brand perception, because if you ask a room full of people quite often in the UK, what do you think of Three? They'll say, oh, the network's a bit patchy. It's not great. Now, that's not actually true. I mean, I should say that at this point, that all the studies would say that's not the case. But what they've really focused on is being fun and doing some really clever kind of viral campaigns. So you'd have to look it on YouTube, but they've got a dancing pony and you can go in and customize your video. And they've done a lot of those kind of viral campaigns that have been really well received. They've definitely made me smile. I think they've potentially changed my brand perception, because I've tried to look at it and understand, has it really made people's mind change? But I'm not sure it always does. And I think one of the challenges with this is that a lot of brands will go off to an agency. The agency will come up with a really clever viral campaign. And that will spread like wildfire. And you'll get huge amounts of people looking at this stuff. And they will go through and engage with it. And you get high levels of engagement, high volumes. And people say, that's great. But then we have to say, is it? Is it really great? Because the reality is, did that change people's buying behavior? Was that actually the problem? Do you need to be viral and hilariously funny and engaging? Actually, do you just need to persuade people that yours is the best value or yours works better or anything else? So I think there's some very good viral campaigns out there at the moment. But I would say that actually, I want to know if they've actually worked in terms of changing sales. And that's not always easy to do. And one of my favorites was always the Tippex bear. So the Shoot the Bear video, which has been around for years old now. And it was, you went in and the bear popped up in the background. You said, shoot the bear, don't shoot the bear. And then it said, I don't want to shoot this bear. What should I do? And you could put anything in. You could type anything in, dance with the bear, play football with the bear, whatever it may be. And they had a video ready that would play back. It was a really clever interactive campaign. It went through, it engaged you. It was a very smartly done kind of thing. That got lots and lots of repeat visits. That worked from a branding point of view, though, because it addressed the key issue. You think, what has shooting a bear got to do with Tippex, which is correction fluid? You know, it allows you to get rid of things. And what it actually did is it made a young demographic. It made a load of people that weren't aware this product even existed anymore aware of it. So it got to that youth-based audience. So from that point of view, it worked. So I think there's lots of clever brands doing funny stuff. I think what's really important is, how do we tie that back to, did it actually change the business outcome? And I'm fascinated to see case studies. And there's not that many case studies out there where you see the whole thing. And again, authenticity this comes down to as well. If you look at the Pepsi Refresh campaign, which is, you know, a good few years old now, where Pepsi did this thing and said, we're not going to spend all these millions of dollars on going through and just, you know, spending it on Super Bowl ads. What we're actually going to do is give it away to good causes, get people to come in and vote and all those kind of things. I thought it was a brilliant campaign. Loads of people came and voted. Loads of people engaged. During the campaign, sales were up fairly well. But once the campaign stopped, sales went down to pretty much where they were before. And they went back to the kind of traditional form of advertising. Now, is that because it wasn't a good branding campaign? I don't think it's that. But I think there's maybe an authenticity issue where people look at it and go, this is a really clever way of selling Pepsi. It's not necessarily that the brand has fundamentally changed. So I think it comes back to a few things we've spoken about. It's great doing these clever kind of campaigns, but I think understanding the fundamental essence of your brand and what your brand stands for and actually focusing on changing that is what's really key.
Daniel, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
All of the stuff that we write and publish and all the content we give are free. If you just go to targetinternet.com, you'll find our podcast and our blogs and all the other things there. So take a look, and we'd be more than happy to hear from you.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to that in the show notes. Daniel, thank you for being on brand with us.
Thank you very much.
And finally, a big thanks to a mentor of this podcast with a resource that you should know more about. Jay Baer of Convince and Convert has done it again. In addition to being a digital marketing thought leader, speaker, and best-selling author, he's now created a new online resource indexing all of the great marketing podcasts out there. It's called, wait for it, Marketing Podcasts, and you can find it at marketingpodcasts.com. If you like marketing and you like podcasts, you need to check this out. Last but certainly not least, you can find show notes, links to everything we've discussed at branddrivendigital.com. You could also subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, RSS. Speaking of iTunes, It's a great reminder. If you like what you're hearing here on this podcast or on Daniel's Digital Marketing Podcast, head over to iTunes, give us a quick rating or review, help others find the show. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our brand-driven digital event series. Learn more about Twitter Brand Basics, Digital Strategy Bootcamp, and the industry-leading Social Brand Forum, also at Brand Driven Digital right now. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.